Hi everyone, and welcome back to Discerning Consciousness. I'm your host, Ant, and in today's show, once again, I'm joined by the author, Michael Ronin. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Andy. It's really great to be back again.
Thank you. Thank you for agreeing to appear on the show again. So, in today's video, we're going to dive a little bit deeper for an exploration into an e exploration of your recently published book, Modern Masculinity for the Conscious Man. And so last time, Michael, we spoke a little bit about our true nature as human beings,
Right.
not just men, women as well, of course, and how society seeks to suppress that at every turn. And then towards the end of our discussion, we were coming onto the theme of relationships, weren't we? About how men and women relate to one another. And how, from your interpretation, as you adequately explain in the book, there is almost this war in love. So I wonder if we could first of all start by this idea of dysfunctional relating, or what is it that's dysfunctional, I should say, about relationships, Michael?
Yeah, so clearly men and women have always had fairly dysfunctional ways of relating, but the degree to which they're relating in contemporary terms is highly dysfunctional. And so it's been getting worse generation by generation, and there are lots and lots of variables as to why that is. At the heart of it all, men and women are designed for each other. Despite our contemporary levels of dysfunction, we're actually designed for each other. We're a very good fit for each other, energetically speaking, obviously. We've co-evolved together. So there's obviously something very good about men and women. But currently we're getting it very wrong. And that's one of the themes that I explore in the book. So men and women are not just optional extras for each other. We actually need each other. And so we need to get back to healthy ways of relating. Being in a relationship with a significant other is, I think, is actually perhaps the most difficult spiritual path that we can undertake as human beings. It's very difficult. For better or worse, certainly nowadays, the union between men and women has, in comparison to traditional ways of relating, the traditional ways of the early and middle 20th century, which was more about duty and sacrifice and procreation than it was about being in a loving dyad, a loving relationship with another person. These days, we see relationships and experience them as being more of like an intensely focused wrestling match with each other, with our inner demons as well as our inner angels. That's what makes it a spiritual path. We're actually aiming for a whole new level of intimacy that we really didn't have. Previously, marriage and partnerships were not really that wasn't the mission. The mission was to do one's duty, to have children and to give them a better life. It wasn't really, the focus was not so much about the love aspect. So we've brought love into marriage and or relationships. And in modern times, these intimate relationships are actually the new temple, if you like, where we're brought face to face with each other's shadows and light. But so what that does is that it gives us an opportunity. It's actually quite unnatural, but it gives us an opportunity to use this as a spiritual path and relate consciously with each other, and actually use it as a mechanism for personal growth, as well as, just the experience of being adored by another person.
Of course. Yeah. So would you say
So.
that once upon a time, long ago, before the modern era, you would say that intimate relationships between men and women in this instance, they were much more, they had sort of much more of a functional characteristic. Is that what you were alluding to? They were, there wasn't so much emphasis upon the interrelation between the man and woman. It was more just around child rearing. It was about
Yeah, it was
accumulation of resources.
exactly. It was just primarily an economic arrangement without any particular commitment to intimacy, which is difficult to wrap your head around nowadays. But yeah, marriage was basically a contract, an economic contract. Nowadays we have more choice about what we bring into our lives, who we bring into our lives, where we live, which community we live, which where we go to work, which employer we choose, which partner we choose, or which partners plural we choose. If you want to be in a polyamorous relationship, you can choose to do so these days. We're no longer confined by the norms of the past. We can actually choose so much more than we historically were able to. There's a what we're getting also is a surfeit of choice, and that brings with it concerns and anxieties, contemporary concerns and anxieties. So we're struggling with so much choice about how to conduct our lives, where historically our lives were much more constrained. The choices were decided for us by where we were born into society. If you look at the rate of breakups these days, it's enormous, absolutely enormous to compare to the historical rates of breakup. Divorces are far more easy to come by. Divorces were frowned upon in the past. So the concept of marriage is struggling because of certain expectations that one person can like fulfill all the roles that were previously part of tribal social dynamics more broadly. Because of the atomization of society, we don't really find ourselves, in the traditional either extended family scenario or the hunter-gatherer tribal group. Those things are largely banished to history now, and we find ourselves either in nuclear family situations or single parenthood situations, or just single. And that makes it quite kind of difficult to relate when we don't have the kind of influences around us. So we still want commitment. We still want family life. We want social status. We want economic support. But we want all of those things provided by just one person these days. We don't look to our wider community to provide them for us. We want our lover to be our best friend, the one we actually have deep, meaningful conversations with, our trusted confidant. We want them to be our rock, our security, to provide stability for us. And at the same time, we also want to go on fun vacations or holidays with them. We want stimulation and we want adventure. We want the reliability and the predictability of a relationship, but we also want that spark. We want novelty and spontaneity, and all of those within w provided for by one person. This makes it very difficult to harmonize all of those different aspects just in one relationship.
Yeah, so it's almost impossible because a thought that I've often had about the difficulties of modern relationships, as you're pointing to, Michael, is the fact that we don't really live in communities as such, and the corporate world provides our food, provides our shelter, provides our employment. So it's very hard, I've always thought, to have meaningful relationships in that context. Whereas when you're building real communities with people, you're actually building physical homes and communities, and growing food. I don't mean to overly romanticize that because it's a tough life, but you're relating on a level with people that's quite deep and profound, because you have to rely on one another for your own survival. The corporation isn't there. And I feel that that's why a lot of relationships tend to fail, because like you were saying, there's too much pressure within a society that's so dysfunctional.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, but it also presents an opportunity.
Of course.
You know, we can take what we're given and use it. Because we are so atomized and we're so focused on, in the sense, romantic relationships, you know, we can choose to, you know, you can start, you can be in an intentional community, which is far more all-encompassing, and where the it's less focused and more diffused in terms of how we relate with each other. And that'll give you different opportunities as well. You know, I think we're coming back to that sort of, I mean, I anticipate and hope that we will be coming more and more into unity consciousness, where we're coming back to seeing each other as fractals of the divine, if you like, and learning how to live in harmony with each other. Sorry, I'm just recovering from a cold right now.
Oh, sorry.
Excuse me, everybody. But in the meantime, we can take what we have and use it to create better individuals. We can work on ourselves, and we can create better ways of relating. You know, it's an intense experiment that we're asking ourselves to do, is to be in relationship with one person and see that one person as being the sole provider of everything we need. It's kind of unrealistic, but if you hold that concept in consciously in that respect, and in the one hand, it's a paradox. You know that it's unrealistic, but you can also work with that and stand in that paradox.
So is that what your advice would be for a conscious man, as a beginning point of understanding how they can navigate relationships in a more healthy and sort of fulfilling way?
I think the first thing the conscious man needs to do is work on himself. And that means coming into his own integrity and living from his heart, coming into alignment with his core essence. And that fully embraces both the masculine and feminine within him. So a man in his divine essence is, he's unconcerned with, you know, like becoming more masculine, becoming more dominant or powerful or mission driven or successful or confident. All of those things are great, but a lot of men do that for the purpose of attracting a woman, you know, because that's what women are attracted to. Now, I would suggest that he should start with who he is at his core and be that, be the authentic version of himself, rather than making himself into something that women will be attracted to. He wants to be the best version of himself and present that best version to the world and draw into his life women who are attracted to his own unique expression of himself. You know, he's certain about himself. He's resolved and comfortable in his own skin. And he may not be like the typical manly man, but he is fully who he is supposed to be. And, you know, the main problem for men in relationships with their woman is that they're largely unskillful. We're not taught how to relate with each other. We don't have any classes. We don't learn about this at school. We're just supposed to understand it at some unknown visceral level and be good at it.
A few rom-coms.
Right. And rom-coms are basically written and produced from the female perspective. It's about her fantasy fairy tale man that she wants in her life. You know, men would do well to have romance movies from the male perspective as well. You know, then it's sorry, I'm having to clear my throat again.
It's okay.
So then the number one thing a man needs to actually look for in a woman when considering pairing up with her, it's really very simple. It's the first thing he should do is ask himself, is the woman actually capable of being in a relationship? Because many women have many, many fine traits and qualities. They may be really attractive, really beautiful, really appealing, but many of them are absolutely incapable of behaving themselves in a relationship. So that's the preeminent question that the conscious man has to ask himself is, before all of those, I mean, we're attracted to what we're attracted to in a woman. But if she is incapable of being in a relationship with a growth mindset, with a conscious man, then sadly, he would do well to reject her in favor of someone who is more evolved in that respect. And the reason I say that is because many women are simply incapable of being in a relationship. And yet, you know, they spend far more time reading about relationships, both fiction and nonfiction, watching TV and movies about relationships, talking with their girlfriends about relationships. So you would think that women would be a whole lot better than men at being in relationships. But empirically, it seems that women are becoming less and less capable in spite of their interest in relationships.
Sorry, carry on, Mark. Yeah, you used the phrase to know how to behave in a relationship. A lot of women don't know how to behave. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, well, rather than, so that their perception of men is colored by numerous unrealistic representations of men in movies, in songs, magazines, chick flicks, you know, online, you know, romantic comedies. Let's take romantic comedies. They present the male lover as someone who will sacrifice his well-being for her. He'll sacrifice his friends, his career. He'll even sacrifice his life. You know, think of Titanic, the movie Titanic.
Sure.
In order to demonstrate to the woman his unconditional love for her, he exists to simply exist to serve her romantic needs. And so she internalizes all of these numerous influences around her. Her perception of what to expect from real men, real life men, shifts in that direction, to this unrealistic direction. And men discover that they're unable to live up to her expectations. You know, and her shopping list of requirements from men that she wants to be there in terms of a relationship with that man, and to which she believes she's entitled. And this is exacerbated by our current culture, where women are being socialized to be antagonistic and even feel superior towards men. They're constantly on the lookout for men's faults in order to give themselves a feeling of moral superiority. One of the other variables that is feminism as well, and that feminism challenged women to compete with men in all aspects of life that were traditionally male dominated. But the thing is, the equality that they demanded was equality of masculinity, not equality of femininity with masculinity. The result, because they demanded equality of masculinity, women have developed these strongly integrated male approaches to their life. And so they function more from a male psychology. It's what Carl Jung called the animus-possessed persona. And so many modern women they have this disdain, this sense of disdain, not only for men, but also for their own feminine side, their feminine aspect. And this makes them incapable of receiving in the sense of that feminine energy of receptivity. So even if they receive positive appreciation from a man, many women perceive it as aggression or harassment. You know, if a man gives her a compliment, or it's more and more likely these days that she will see it less as a compliment and more as being some sort of an aggressive attempt to come onto her
The
that is
phrase
unwelcome.
that we hear is it the words microaggression, we're familiar with that, and also mansplaining and things like that. I remember once a few years ago there was an article in The Guardian, and it was written by a woman, and yeah, it was all about the the horrors of mansplaining on the London Underground. So
I remember
it's interesting again in the it's almost like I see this as a diversionary. It just creates more discord and disharmony within relationships. And if one was thinking from a conspiratorial mindset and the controllers of society, like we discussed a little bit last time, Michael, there is I think there's a deliberate element to that, to create a kind of society where there are divisions between men and women, and men, younger men coming, into maturity, they're now thinking, well, do I open the woman? Sorry, do I open the door for the woman, I should say, in the office, or all of those things. Whereas once of our generation, when we were younger, it was a given that that was a polite, gentlemanly thing to do. Now all of those things, there's all these questions around the appropriateness of behaviours from men towards women, unfortunately.
You were talking about it perhaps being intentional, and I think I'd have to agree. I think feminism is basically a proxy war. It's a war that the ruling class is waging against ordinary people, and it's a proxy war in the sense that they can get a phony war going between men and women, because men and women, as I said right at the beginning, we are designed for each other. We're made for each other. We are supposed to be good for each other. But look around you. So feminism is actually a very, very powerful organization. It has billions of dollars behind it. It's an industry in and of itself. Not many people realize that. And you know, I have to say that I was a feminist for 30 years. I was a feminist. I believed in feminism. I believed in a, you know, I believed in a fairer, kinder world. And I thought that once the inequalities between the sexes had been addressed, such a world would come to pass. And you see, feminism passes itself off as a social good in a way that makes it invisible to others, and the harm it does is insidious. It can do so because, as a society, we see women or femininity as the good sex. Men are the bad sex. Men are toxic, and men must be tamed and subdued so as to reverse all the historical aggressions of the past, and then step off the plate. So, you know, there came a time, well, I should say that, you know, I've been on women's marches. I automatically favored all sorts of legislation put forward to redress any perceived imbalance between the sexes. And I cared about women's issues, and I still care about women's issues today. So I'm not anti-woman. I am critical of modern femininity. I'm harshly critical of feminism, but I'm not anti-woman. And there came a time when I felt conned by feminism. And you know, the theme is, if it often is, if you're against feminism, then you have to be against women, because feminism is about struggles for equality, and it isn't. It really isn't. And I go into why it isn't in the book. So I am for women. I'm for women, and I'm also for men. I'm for both sexes, realizing their full potential as human beings. But my own internal bias favored women's voices above men's voices for 30 years because of the ongoing injustices that I believe they experienced as a group. So I understand it. I understand that when a man challenges feminism, the automatic assumption is that he is misogynistic, or that he's trying to defend his privileged position as a man and is trying to muddy the water. So, in my own journey, it wasn't until I heard an attack on feminism coming from the mouth of a woman that I started to question my own belief paradigm. I would never have listened to a man rebuking feminism. It was only when I heard a woman rebuking it that I heard the arguments behind the dark side of feminism. And now I, and the beauty is that I can now hear men's pain where before I was just deaf to it. So, it's actually brought me more into alignment with both men and women.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, Michael, I wonder if you if we could cover the area of what we were talking about before we came on air, and that is different types of relationships. Obviously, as we were speaking about before, that there are many different types, and that's one of the good things about the openness and freedom that we do enjoy in modern society. Obviously, in spite, and we know we're talking about the problems of relating between men and women in relationships. But yeah, I wonder if we could just touch upon that subject.
Yeah, there's an evolution in personal evolution that we go through in our lives, and the sorts of relationships that we invite into our lives, based on how mature we are, essentially. And we go through various stages where we move from immature behavior to very mature behavior. So the stages of relationships that I've identified are, there are four of them. There's the at the beginning, there's the sensory relationship, and then you have the growth relationship, and then you have the partnership relationship, and then you have what I'm calling the divine union. So the most immature relationship is the sensory relationship, and this is where men and women are more focused on the thrill of being in a relationship, the adventure of it, the challenge and the conquest and the fun. And it's where they're more focused on the physical side of the relationship, doing fun things together, going on hikes, going on holidays or vacations, doing activities together that they both enjoy. And it's heavily, but particularly this relationship is heavily oriented towards having sex. It's a sensory relationship, so it's wall-to-wall sex, and they're interested in the heat of a passionate relationship, sparks and fire and vitality. So there's there is this kind of erotic polarity in this relationship, and they're fairly superficial. They're a hell of a lot of fun, and they're great. There is this, there's this intense feeling of aliveness of being in a sensory relationship. I mean, what's not to like about the thrill of living, the thrill of feeling fully and being alive? But there's not much work being done about how to relate with each other. It's just enjoying the experience of being with each other and just like sucking out all that live energy from it. That there's very little codependence in this relationship, but there's some, but the bonds of codependency are not very strong, and it's usually short-lived. And so are the relationships. These relationships basically go away after the new car smell has worn off. They often end explosively as well. You know, both of them get into a huge row or huge argument and call it quits, and then they dive straight into the next sensory relationship. So there's that, and we've all been there. They're all great fun, but eventually we start growing up and wondering if we can get some, if there's something that we're missing, you know, some depth within the relationship that we're missing. And so we choose to be with someone, not just for the sensory experience of it, but also with the things which transcend that as well. And in a growth relationship, this is where people become interested in their responses and patterns within themselves. They're also much more aware of the deficits in relationships, but they don't really understand why. They feel the deficits. They get into arguments a lot of the time, and they, what's going on behind the scenes is that their partner is their teacher. They don't realize their partner is their teacher,
sure.
But they're learning about how to relate with each other and getting it wrong. They're not relating in healthy ways. They're arguing with each other. They're being triggered by each other. Lots and lots of their shadows are coming to the surface and seeing the light of day. And that's a good thing. But, you know, there's a lot of battling that's going on. I mean, equally, there's a lot of codependence. They may be trying to be the good guy or the nice guy or the good girl. But the principle purpose of this relationship is to come to some new inner equilibrium, and a new ways of being and relating with their man or with their woman that they either accept or reject. These relationships can actually last for a very, very long time. You know, it's like long-term marriages. That nobody is happy in, but they both stay in it together. But they're mirrors for each other. There are lessons that they're learning as they're in their unhappiness, that they are internalizing some lessons about what it is to be in an unhealthy relationship and relate in unhealthy ways. So that's potentially a growth relationship. And then you get the next level, which is a partnership relationship. And here, the participants are more fully integrated. They've reached a greater level of appreciation and respect for both themselves and their partner. And they've become highly attuned to themselves and their partner. And they recognize their triggers, their reactivities. And when those strong feelings do arise within the relationship, instead of being derailed by those strong emotions, it's almost like they're surfing the waves of their emotions. They're riding on top of those waves. And their primitive drives have been reconciled. They're still there. They still exist. They're still there, but they're acknowledged, and it's a part of the relationship. And they're quickly able to reconnect with themselves. They become very present. They're able to calm themselves down, and self-control becomes greater. So whereas in the growth relationship, they may repress uncomfortable emotions that come up. In the partnership relationship, it's more about self-control rather than repression. There's greater patience and acceptance, which flows around them. And both people reciprocate very, very easily. Each person's needs and desires are balanced with the other person's needs and desires. So there's this trust that they develop. It becomes far more peaceful and trusting. the kids may have left home if it's a long-term relationship, and they're still together. They don't divorce because they still find value in each other, even though the kids may have kept them together at some point or other. It's, they have a personal connection which bonds them, and there's less passion, fewer sparks, fewer fire, and safety rather than excitement is what keeps them together. They're very comfortable together. So yeah, it's that compassionate communication is really the norm of that sort of relationship.
Would you also
So
say that, sorry to interrupt, would you also say that there's an element to which I'm thinking of sort of in terms of emotions, there's almost an alchemical process going on here, when you were talking about, recognizing uncomfortable emotions when they come to the surface and perhaps even transforming them and working through them. There's almost a sort of fluidity to the process rather than labeling difficult emotions as they come up and wanting to restrain them and feeling uncomfortable. There's almost this an embracing process going on.
We're wounded. You, I, and everybody on this planet are wounded. We carry within us these woundings and shadow aspects. And in a relationship, because it's so highly charged, highly focused, these woundings come to the surface more easily than they do with your friends or with your employer or whoever else. We feel safe to, in a sense, we feel safer to allow those shadow aspects to come out and see the light of day. And what we want is for those shadow aspects to be met with unconditional love. What often happens is they're not, depending upon the maturity of our partner. In the divine union, which is the highest order of relationship, these shadow aspects are met with unconditional but critical acceptance. They're allowed to come out, and it's so all the annoyances and the fears that we have and the difficulties we experience, all of these are catalyzed by the presence of our beloved, but in the divine union, it's embraced as it, they are embraced as essential components in the path of love. And so we bring into our relationship all those conditioned aspects of our nature, which have not yet been integrated. All of our worries, all of our concerns, our likes and our dislikes, all the personal needs that we have within us that up until now potentially have never been met. So it all comes rushing out. So there is actually a what happens is that our nervous system gets triggered and it needs to resolve itself back to a baseline of ease and well-being. So in the divine union, by when we hold space for when our partner has been like captured by this threat response, we actually empower them. They feel more capable of negotiating that emotional reaction for themselves in the future. So they don't have to do it all by themselves. They have someone who's going to give them sweet medicine as well. So we're not when it's not spiritual bypassing, but in the
No.
divine union, it's a mutually healing relationship.
So there's a re reciprocity within this dimension then, or dynamic, I should say.
And that's why I'm really enthusiastic about this modern the modern times where we're looking to each other to basically fulfill each other. And I'm basically saying, let's do that consciously. Let us allow us to evolve our consciousness, co-creatively, and see it as a whole new opportunity of intimacy as a sacred path, as a path of ascension, involving like this. So it allowing us to explore and cultivate the unformed and unintegrated aspects of ourselves and our beloved, as well as, you know, the stuff that makes our heart sing. It's why we're in relationships. We want our hearts to sing. We want, you know, that, but we can't just push away all the stuff we don't like and expect to have a healthy relationship. We need to embrace those shadow aspects to evolve into a better sort of way of relating. And so the divine union is where we do that. We see each other for who they are. We see each other at the soul level, at the animal level, at every level. You know, it's actually seeing God in each other, whether you believe in God or not. It's a relationship where you're accepted for who you are. You know, not in the kind of naive sense where, you know, any behavior is acceptable.
No, there's still clear boundaries, of course. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, you know, we're embracing the process of being who we are now, with how we are evolving and improving. So yeah,
and it's thanks for that. It's interesting. Obviously, we've already seen during lockdowns of various guises across the world that's placed an enormous strain on relationships. I mean, one thinks of the way in which certain types of relationships, they only survive because people aren't living cheek by jowl, and they go out to the office and they can maintain a relationship because they're not together all the time and they've been forced together. Or we've got horrific situations of people you know, being abused, and normally their escape route might be work or to get out and visit friends, and they haven't had that option. And of course you've got those people who would be involved in affairs or extramarital affairs, and to a large degree that option's been closed off, or at least it's been made a lot more difficult. So there's been, since the COVID pandemic hit, there's been massive impact on relationships, and it will be interesting to see. I think you slightly alluded towards the end of your book that we could be entering quite a difficult period in terms of people's economics, or the economics and the finances of the world, shall we say. And it might be that there's even more pressures placed upon people in relationships going forward, which is, like you were saying, but that's all a good thing in terms of opportunities for growth, because we are in this shake-up period now in human history. So how do you see as we're coming up to the end of our allocated time here, Michael, how do you see relationships between men and women morphing and changing in the coming years and decades?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So we have this opportunity, but we also have huge obstacles that we have to overcome. And the book basically goes into what those obstacles are, so that, you know, you, as a man, you have a choice. You can either allow yourself to be surprised by what life has to offer you and embrace it. Or you could choose to be well informed and not be so surprised. So this book is about informing men about what the greatest pitfalls, obstacles, and pressures are that he's going to experience in his life. So, you know, both of those things are absolutely fine. You know, if you want to take life as you find it, and not be influenced by the thoughts of others, that's as equally and valid a strong position as the one I'm saying, which is to be as informed as possible. So, like I was saying, that there, as you brought up at the beginning as well, that there is the war of the sexes. That, you know, we know about the war of the sexes, and essentially, what that means is that there cannot be peace between men and women as long as as long as there is war in love. And love is what will heal us. We need love. But if you're blind, then certain things will derail love. So we need certain higher virtues that support loving energy, that the conscious man will be wise to cultivate within himself. So he needs to cultivate wisdom, cultivate, excuse me, he needs to cultivate his wisdom, his intelligence, his clarity, his intuition, his compassion, his honesty, his authenticity, and so on. At the same time, recognizing that male and female relations are tragically broken. You know, I'm going to say it right now, there is a war against men, and that's not meant as a metaphorical flourish. And the poison is feminism. And if you're surprised about what I'm saying, then I would urge you to read the book and understand why, because obviously we've only got a few minutes left. But
sure, yeah.
Essentially, the feminist narrative is that if you weaken men, you'll make women stronger. And you know, that is just deluded.
And we can see the effects all around us in modern society of that kind of delusion, can't we, really? And we all know what's happening within society. So
So although the state of affairs these days is very discouraging, to my mind, it's almost an impossibility to find a woman who is capable of living in harmony with a man. My sincere hope is that men and women can take a path forward where we collectively own our shadow aspects and celebrate each other, celebrate what the opposite sex brings to our lives, create new men and women, new ways of being with each other that bring out the best in each other, create a world where both sexes feel respected and safe and excited to be in the presence of each other, because they're not right now. They're not, you know, where women can fully inhabit their feminine aspect as much as they choose, where men can look to each other as brothers rather than adversaries. And which is what we have now, you know. Let's find a world where we can love each other freely and vulnerably and authentically. So I go into a lot about, you know, what that would look like, what sort of complementary arrangements we could construct in order to support that loving energy. And also looking at our childhood experiences, the wounding that we got from our parents, and how that colors our perceptions as adults, and how our relationships with our beloved can help heal our childhoods, as long as we choose that. If we can choose to be that sort of partner for each other. I also call in the book for an age of healing, and I believe we're here to heal each other. We're so fucked up as a species right now, and that, you know, if we don't sort ourselves out anytime soon, we're going to annihilate ourselves. So we need to resolve ourselves back to a baseline of ease and well-being, because what we have right now is we're the walking wounded. We're all bleeding, and we can't see. This blood is invisible, but it's dripping off us. Everybody is suffering in this world to such an extent that they cannot resolve themselves back to a healthy way of being. So sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and we're seeing that, aren't we, with the kind of disastrous geopolitical situation going on at the moment. It's almost like an outward expression of what you're talking about, our own psychologies, the potential disastrous situation in Ukraine, Russia, and in China and Taiwan and Iran and Israel, these ongoing situations. They're almost mirrors, aren't they? To our own individual psychology. And yeah, like you say, it on the one hand, it's quite concerning, but I almost feel, just sort of to round things up, We've gone so far in one direction of misunderstanding. We've gone so far in a direction of conflict, disharmony. It's almost as if there's no other way now but to ping back to some sense of balance or just to be annihilated, like you said. Do you know,
Right.
I don't mean to catastrophize, but that's the point I feel that humanity's at right now. And as I say, it's been reflected in the sort of global political situation as well.
Yeah, we've actually reached a do or die scenario.
Yeah, that's the good phrase. Yeah, it's a good phrase.
You know, we're at such a level of this dysfunction now, such a high all-time level of dysfunction in our society. I mean, the good news is that we're also at such a high level of consciousness as well.
Yes.
We're able to see
Yes.
more and more of us are able to see the self-destructive mass delusion that's all around us. And we can observe the majority, let's call them, cheering it on, you know, people basically blowing themselves up. So we've reached that point in our consciousness, our co-evolution, where in order to survive as a species, we have a choice. We can either do nothing, or we should do something. So my suggestion is that we claim ourselves, reclaim ourselves, take power back into our own hands, and become fully sovereign. Not in the personal sense, or I should say both in the personal sense and the collective sense, become sovereign individuals, because there is a war on consciousness, there is a war on ordinary people,
Absolutely.
and we if we do nothing, then we will be conquered for good. For good. There will be no getting going back. We are at that precipice. So
Sure.
this means no longer seeing ourselves as subject to the authority of our rulers, the ruling class. It means revoking our consent to be governed. And it means delegitimizing those aspects of authority which are not in our best interests, and legitimizing ourselves.
Absolutely, and that's what COVID in the last year has demonstrated so well. It's time for us to step into our empowerment and sovereignty. Thank you
Yeah.
so much, Michael, for joining us today. Before we finish, I wonder if you could just share with the audience how they can purchase your new publication, your new book.
Oh yeah, thanks, Sam.
Sorry.
So it's the name of the book is Modern Masculinity for the Conscious Man by Michael Ronan, and it's available at Amazon right now. I also have a website which is half constructed. It's michaelronan.net. And if you'd like to get in touch with me at all, then you can contact me through the website.
I'll put those links in the description box so people can purchase the book there and communicate with you if they feel the need to, which I imagine they will because we've covered so much ground. And I think a lot of people at the moment are feeling, due to the censorship, a lot of what we've spoken about in these two videos, people can't actually express in modern world anymore.
Right.
And it's good to have the opportunity to talk about what is regarded as controversial in modern, in a censorial type of society. So,
Exactly, exactly.
yeah. So, thank you everyone for joining us today. Hope you've enjoyed our discussion today. And thank you again, Michael, for appearing on Discerning Consciousness. It's been really fantastic to get your to hear all about the main themes and discussion around your book. So thank you
Thanks,
so
Sam.
much.
It's
Thank you
been a
very
real
much.
pleasure.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.